We are back. It is February 28th, 2024. The time is 2013 hours Eastern Standard Time, Eastern Time, as we call it. But it's not yet daylight savings. Should be March 10th when that begins. The time is 13 minutes after 2000 hours or 2013 hours. Eastern time, and I'm a little bit taken out of my regular routine today, having been out shopping a couple of days ago, and now I'm, or was it yesterday? Yesterday, it was yesterday, and I've got to get back into the routine I was in before, which is more difficult. I did talk to a lot of people yesterday, and that's why. But our study today is fairly short, too, our readings, so that's good. And I think we can cover the material without too much trouble. I'm having some problems with one of my texting apps. I'm going to have to maybe change over to use a different phone number for some of my sources that are using that number, but it works. It just doesn't work every single time I'm trying to use it. It's intermittent service or something. It works in the mornings, apparently, better than in the afternoon or something like that, but I can't guarantee that that's going to continue or what's going to happen. But that's very troubling to me because it's a free app, but I have another free app that doesn't so far show any of those problems. It's the same app with a different phone number in a different location. So I can't recommend that app because it's not working for me. So I don't want to give the name of it. But let's get to today's study, shall we? Like I said, it's February 28th, 2024. The biblical account we're talking about in Chapter 7, Paragraph 7 of the Crucible of Credible Creed, published 2012 initially. The biblical account may not specifically give the year in which Isaac experienced a famine in Canaan. It doesn't give the year because the Bible is not a history book that gives dates. We don't know the dates from the Bible. We know them from calculating and researching and, you know, investigating astronomy and all the history of different nations and all of archaeology. That's how the genealogy came about, using online research by yours truly. And so we do have the date from our chronology, but the Bible account doesn't give the year in which Isaac experienced a famine in Canaan. Still, the time range in our chronology, or which is not even, no, according to the research of Mr. Bond, the time range is within 200 years after 2200 BCE. He found ice ages every 1500 years, and one of them began in 2200 BCE. And they continued for about 200 years. Each of these ice ages was about 200 years. That this was correlated to the famines. The ice age correlates to a famine. And this period of 200 years was nearly the same as one ice age. In other words, it's approximate, I suppose, as Mr. Bond's study allowed it to be 200 years, but he didn't give how accurate that number is. There is consonance, at least we didn't record that accuracy. I don't think we knew about the accuracy, which there should be an accuracy or an error estimate on all numbers in science. But so there should have been an error estimate associated with that 200 years. We don't know. And there should have been an error estimate associated with the 2200 BCE also. But we didn't get one. Still, we have those numbers from 2200 to 2000 BCE approximately for this time of this famine. There is consonance in the chronology. Moreover, because a famine was reported by an Egyptian named Hekanakt, as was referred to in the last paragraph, and this famine was shortly after the range we took for the time of Isaac's famine, and Jehovah allows the time of Isaac, therefore, like the time of Abraham, to have been plagued with famine. Except we're only saying as it here suffices, or as we might believe to be necessary to account for the Bible describing these famines. So Jehovah had commanded Abraham to sacrifice his only son in the land of Moriah. That's from Genesis 21:33-34. That was not there. He was in Beersheba at the time, just prior to this mention of the land of Moriah. And then the next chapter of Genesis 22:2, that's where it mentions the land of Moriah, where the true God, Yahweh, told Abraham to take Isaac and make a trip to the land of Moriah in that verse 2 of chapter 22 of Genesis. It's an easy verse number to remember. Genesis 22:2. So, the land of Moriah. Now, the later Jewish tradition would tell us that we know that David purchased land from an Israelite, and it came to be known, it was the thrashing floor of Ornan, I believe, the Jebusite. He purchased, so he wasn't an Israelite, actually. He was a Jebusite, I suppose. He was living in Jerusalem at the time. So this Mount Moriah was in Jerusalem, and this is where David purchased this piece of land. And that was where David built the altar and offered a sacrifice, and that came to be later on the location of the Temple of Solomon. This Mount Moriah, and the Jews in their Jewish tradition believe that this thrashing floor of Ornan the Jebusite was actually the same place as where Isaac had been nearly slaughtered by Abraham, and that it was the place they believe where Abraham offered up a sheep in sacrifice in place of Isaac, the place referred to in Genesis 22:2 as the land of Moriah. Now, Jehovah had commanded Abraham to sacrifice his only son in the land of Moriah, but then Jehovah relented, and when Abraham showed obedience to offer Isaac, as Abraham was beginning to take the knife to kill Isaac, an angel stopped him, and when Abraham saw a ram caught in a thicket by its horns, he realized that this was what Jehovah wanted him to offer up. And so he offered that ram up in place of Isaac, and Isaac's life was spared because the angel told Abraham not to slaughter Isaac, whereas Abraham had been told prior to that he was to slaughter his son and offer him in sacrifice. And that's why he was going there, and that's why they were on Mount Moriah, or in the land of Moriah, as it was called, to do that at that time. So it's fascinating that this sacrifice came to be the same place where the temple was, at least according to the Jewish tradition, that's where the temple was also built by Solomon. And that's where the altar was, where they offered burnt sacrifices during the time of Solomon and thereafter, until the temple was destroyed in BCE 587. And of course it was rebuilt in the days in the sixth year of Darius. The temple was completed, which is the year 517 BCE, exactly 70 years after the destruction of the temple in BCE 587. Our scripture for today, little ones, our proverb is Proverbs from Ecclesiastes 7 and 8. Better is the end afterward of a matter than its beginning. Better is one who is patient than one who is haughty in spirit. So the patience of Abraham in being patient and waiting for the angel to give him a new instruction not to slaughter Isaac, and then the patience of all of the Israelites waiting for King David to purchase the thrashing floor of Ornan, and then for Solomon to build the temple on that site of Mount Moriah, and then the waiting that came about after the temple was restored in 517 BCE, and also all the way down to the time of the offering of Jesus as a sacrifice in place of all the animal sacrifices to replace them permanently in CE 30, in 30 CE, the crucifixion of Jesus as the ransom sacrifice for all of mankind, not just for the Jews, because the nations were also to be included in this remarkable new covenant that wasn't true of the old covenant, which only involved the Jews. Better is one who is patient than one who is haughty in spirit. 1 Chronicles 18, and it came about afterward that David proceeded to strike down the Philistines and subdue them and take Gath and its dependent towns out of the hand of the Philistines. Then he struck Moab down, and the Moabites came to be David's servants, bearing tribute. And David went on to strike down Hadadezer, the king of Zobah at Hamath. I'm just checking to see that my audio looks functional and so on. It looks good. As he was going his way to set up his control at the river Euphrates, the king of Zobah was struck down by David. Further, David captured from him 1,000 chariots and 7,000 horsemen, verse 4, and 20,000 men on foot. Then David hamstrung all the chariot horses, but he let 100 chariot horses of them remain. When Syria of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, the king of Zobah, David went striking down among the Syrians 22,000 men. After that, David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians came to be David's servants, bearing tribute. And Jehovah, Yahweh, again we have the divine name, the true God, kept giving salvation to David wherever he went. Moreover, David took the circular shields of gold that happened to be on the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. And from Tibhath and Kun, cities of Hadadezer, David took very much copper. With it, Solomon made the copper sea and the pillars and the copper utensils. There was a place south of the Salt Sea where all the copper was forged that the archaeologist Levy found this site, apparently, because there was a big copper forgery, a big place where they could forge all these utensils and things, all the giant pillars, everything could be forged in this foundry that they found south of the Salt Sea in the area of vicinity of the Araba, the valley of the Salt Sea. It was the valley between the Salt Sea and the Gulf of whichever Gulf that is of the Red Sea, Aqaba, I guess, the Gulf of Aqaba. When two when Tōyū, or Tōu, I guess it could be pronounced Tō, when Tō, the king of Hamath, heard that David had struck down all the military force of Hadadezer, the king of Zobah, he immediately sent Hadoram, his son, to King David to ask him about his welfare and congratulate him over the fact that he had fought against Hadadezer, so that he struck him down. For Hadadezer had become trained in warfare against Tō, and there were with him all sorts of articles of gold and silver and copper. These also David, King David, sanctified to Jehovah, together with the silver and the gold that he had carried off from all the nations, from Edom and from Moab and from the sons of Ammon and from the Philistines and from Amalek. As for Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, he struck down the Edomites in the Valley of Salt, 18,000. So he put garrisons in Edom, and all the Edomites came to be David's servants, and Jehovah kept saving David wherever he went. And David continued to reign over Israel. Look at that verse 13. Yahweh kept saving David wherever he went. That's interesting, isn't it? That when Jehovah, or Yahweh, when he had a servant, it still applies today, when he had a servant such as David, he would look after that servant and save him. And David continued to reign over all Israel, and he was continually rendering judicial decision and righteousness, judicial decision and righteousness for all his people. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. And Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were priests. And Shavshah was secretary. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites. The son of Jehoiada. Perhaps that's a new thought. Perhaps it's pronounced Jehoiada. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites and the Pelethites, and the sons of David were the first in position at the side of the king. So we know quite a bit about the people around David. We know about the priests, their names. Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar. And we have quite a few generations given, which we noted from 1 Chronicles 8, I believe it was, didn't we say? Or was it? No, it's not 8. It was 6. 1 Chronicles, I remember now, 1 Chronicles 6. The sons of Levi, Gershon, Kohath, Merari, but then it gives the priests' names all the way down to Solomon's time. And it looks like we have all of them from the time of the crossing of the Jordan and maybe even prior to that. I mean, but whether there could be generations missing, I suppose there could be, or perhaps the generation was longer. We know both Aaron and Moses lived a long time, more than 120 years before they died. So perhaps their family had longer generation, but you know than average. But the average generation in Moses' time, we think, is 70 or 80 years, based on Psalm 90. It mentions 70 or 80 years as the lifespan. Not the generation, you know, the lifespan of humans. With a longer lifespan, we'd think the generation might be longer too. In other words, the time before a father begat his children might be longer if the father lived longer and his health was extended for such a long period of time, in other words. But There are 14 generations that we counted here in chapter 6 of 1 Chronicles, spanning a period of, well, from about, it's about 400 years, isn't it? Something like that. 400? Yeah. 435, we said? 425. 435, yeah, 435 years for 14 generations is what we calculated as being 31 years per generation. That's what I think, anyway, that's what I believe. Without doing it right now, we will have to do it every time we talk about it, I'll have to do it again. But Hosea, chapter 7, or is it 8? Let's see, I think we're in 7. Chapter 7. Shall we read that? At the time that I would bring healing to Israel, this is Hosea quoting from Jehovah, the error of Ephraim is also actually uncovered, and the bad things of Samaria, for they have practiced falsehood, and a thief himself comes in. A marauder band actually makes a dash on the outside. If they do not say to their own heart that all their badness I will remember, now their dealings have surrounded them in front of my face, they have come to be. In other words, the people didn't know that Jehovah, the true God, Yahweh, was going to remember all their badness. They were in denial about the fact that Yahweh knows everything. Verse 3, by their badness, they make the king rejoice. This is in Israel, though, where the kings were far more corrupt than in the southern kingdom of Judah. And by their deceptions, they make princes rejoice. All of them are adulterers. Like a furnace set burning by a baker who ceases poking after kneading dough until it is leavened. On the day of our king, right, so it's the kneading dough illustration. That's an interesting illustration, is it not? What do we see? There's a reference here in the Insight book under oven. A baker's furnace. They were compared to a baker's furnace. But it's interesting, the kneading dough was not being poked anymore. In other words, the Israelites were not looking for any fault inside themselves. On the day of our king, verse 5, princes have sickened themselves. There is a rage because of wine. He has drawn his hand along with deriders, for they have brought their heart near as to a furnace. It is burning inside them. All night long their baker is sleeping. By morning the furnace is burning as with a flaming fire. They get hot, all of them, like the furnace, and they actually devour their judges. Their own kings have all fallen. None among them is calling out to me. As for Ephraim, it is among the peoples that he personally mingles himself. Ephraim himself has become a round cake, not turned on the other side. Strangers, verse 9, have eaten up his power, and he himself has not come to know it. Also, gray hairs themselves have become white on him, and he himself has not come to know it. And the pride of Israel has testified to his face, and they have not returned to Jehovah their God, nor have they looked for him because of all this. And Ephraim proves to be like a simple-minded dove without heart. To Egypt they have called, to Assyria they have gone. Remember when the siege of Samaria began, Hosea, at some point, he was the final king of Israel before its capture, but he had been appealing to Egypt for help. We know that from our previous readings. And now, so to Egypt they have called, to Assyria they have gone. That might mean that this was written by Hosea after the call was made to Egypt by Hosea. It's not definite, but that's what it might mean. But they also, it says, have gone to Assyria. They also appealed to Assyria for help. That's another thing that we know. Whichever way they go, I shall spread out over them my net. Like flying creatures of the heavens, I shall bring them down. I shall discipline them in agreement with the report to their assembly. But we don't see any evidence yet that Samaria was captured until a later time than this. This is a prophetic thing. Woe to them, for they have fled from me, despoiling to them, for they have transgressed against me. And I myself proceeded to redeem them, but they themselves have spoken lies even against me, and they did not call to me for aid with their heart, although they kept howling on their beds. On account of their grain and sweet wine, they kept loafing about. They kept turning against me. And I, for my part, did disciplining. I strengthened their arms. This is Jehovah speaking when he says, I strengthened their arms. Yahweh says, and he also says, against me, they kept scheming what was bad, even though he strengthened their arms. And they proceeded to return, not to anything higher. They had become like a loose bow. What is a loose bow? We have to find out what that is, if we can. A bow, we know a bow and arrows. Maybe this, a loose bow means the string on the bow is loose. By the sword their princes will fall because of the denunciation of their tongue. This will be their derision in the land of Egypt. So that's interesting. Even mentions Egypt, although it's not clear about their derision in the land of Egypt. Let's see if we can find out what that means. There is a reference here. A loose bow that never hits the mark, it mentions in the Insight book under repentance. Under the heading repentance, mentions this loose bow. It's loose because the aim is not accurate. That's a good interpretation, it seems. But also, what else can we find? Well, it doesn't mention the land of Egypt in that particular reference, I don't believe it. See if we can find anything. They didn't return to the higher or more elevated form of worship. And they didn't call to Jehovah for aid. Even though, in verse 14, they kept howling on their beds. They were howling on their beds, but they didn't ask for the help of Yahweh, the true God. They did not turn to him. Right? In fact, they kept turning against him, and their sweet wine, it said, and their grain made them loaf around. They were lazy because of sweet wine and grain that they were just feasting or eating grain. We can imagine that they wouldn't eat the grain by itself. They'd make bread, right? They'd eat the bread and drink the wine, and that would make them lazy, and probably it made them a bit fat too, because we know carbs can cause a weight gain. So there we see again, wine isn't good. Once again, it makes people lazy. In the same book of Hosea, this time 7 and 14 of Hosea. Fascinating, all the things we're learning, isn't it, little ones? So We don't need to drink wine. In fact, it's better not to. So that's just about our study. We've got a few more minutes to talk about some other things. That concludes the reading and the conversation about the reading for today. Now, what else do we wish to talk about? I know there are a lot of issues with people who think that modern technology makes the Bible obsolete, right? There are a lot of issues nowadays with that. People think, oh no, you know, we're superior, they think, to the ancient peoples who didn't have technology. But technology doesn't make better people. It's sometimes the opposite, in fact. It sometimes prevents people from learning how to be good people. And it takes away some of the time that they would be spending on learning how to be good people, because they're spending time learning about the technology. Oh, I know one thing I want to mention. I watched some of these exploding batteries on video yesterday. There's a YouTube video that was made by a person who's part of an organization that tests these batteries for, you know, explosions. They cause them to explode, and they observe what happens. Or they puncture the batteries and see what happens. And the batteries explode. And sometimes they explode with shrapnel and violent explosions, which are instantaneous, like you could never get away from it. Just explodes in one immediate explosion that you have no warning. Batteries of a car, for example. There was one video of a car that exploded in a car park, and the car, the roof of the car flew upwards. I think it was the roof, but the car exploded. And the roof of the car, or some part of the car, flew upwards and just crashed against the roof of the car park. And there was a video of this, and that was a very violent explosion. That would have killed anybody if it had hit them. I think the shrapnel was moving so fast, it would have killed somebody very easily. But then there are also other cases where there's outgassing of the batteries. It produces this poisonous gas that if you breathe it, it causes great damage to the lungs and all sorts of problems. Breathing, if anyone breathes this gas coming out of these lithium-ion batteries. So lithium-ion batteries are extremely dangerous. And they don't always explode with any warning. They just sometimes just explode without any warning. They're extremely dangerous, extremely dangerous. I just can't emphasize it enough. So that's why for a while there was even a car manufacturer which was recommending not to charge your car near your house. You know, you had to do it on the street because you might blow up. And also in a lower state of charge, they're not as dangerous perhaps, but there's so much to it. But our study's concluded. Our video's over. It's February 28th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 20:46 hours Eastern Time. I'm Ward Green, and I love you. And on my behalf, this is Liv Dusty, and this is Cassie, saying bye for now.